So today I want to share about the Karaniya Metta Sutta, to go through this sutta and speak a little bit about each part. We chant it almost every night, and I want to explore it today because really it's the Buddha's direct instruction to us. Each section and sometimes each verse could be an entire talk in itself. So please understand, I'm going to fly over it. This is a glossing over. But with the intention of giving you a sense of the wholeness of this teaching to support and inspire your practice. Each or most suttas in the early Buddhist texts come with a framing story, and this one is no exception. And I love it because it speaks directly to us as human beings. I don't want to tell it in great detail, but basically the gist of it is that a group of 500 monks had gone to the Buddha, gotten instruction, and then went off to what seemed to be the perfect abiding place at the foot of the Himalayas. And when they got there and found that they would be well received for the 3 months of the rains retreat, they started to practice. And unbeknownst to them, when they got there, there were a group of devas, celestial beings, inhabiting the grove that they were living in. And out of respect for the monks, the celestial beings, when they first got there, the celestial beings came out of their homes, out of the trees. But when it became obvious that the monks were going to stick around for more than a day or two, then they got upset. It's like, what will we do? We're out of our homes all this time. So then they proceeded to terrify the monks with bad odors, with bad sounds, with terrifying visions. And because all the monks were in silence, nobody spoke to each other. But they were all getting really, they were in pretty bad shape. And then they met for the recitation of the Patimokkha and looked around and said, ooh, everybody looked really nice when we got here, and now you all have terrible complexions, and what's going on? And one by one, the monks said, well, this happened to me, and these terrible smells, and these terrible sights, and these terrible sounds. So they decided to take what we would say in English, the nuclear option, and break the rains retreat, because, well, we can't practice here. So they went for, and it was a long way back, but they went back to the Buddha and said, help, help, we can't practice. And of course, his response was, what are you guys doing here? This is the rains retreat, you're not supposed to walk. And they said, but we can't practice, it's too terrifying. And this sutta was his gift to them, because he said, no, you have to go back where you were. But here is a teaching that will help you. And then he delivered this Metta Sutta. So it's his offering of both protection and practice that's beneficial in and of itself, and deeply supports liberating insight. Because at the end of that rains retreat, it's said that all those monks had attained enlightenment. So before we dive in, I want to offer a few introductory remarks. The first is, it's a condensed and graduated teaching. It begins with a series of instructions that relate to the mundane world that we live in, and how we live in it, how we relate to each other, and how we can live our lives so that they're in accord with our deepest aspirations. And then, as the sutta continues, it gradually introduces teachings that proceed through the development of concentration and ultimately leading to the attainment of freedom of mind, the release of mind through loving kindness. So, along the way, this teaching touches on how we can fulfill each of the three trainings of the Eightfold Path, those being ethical conduct, sila, development of concentration, samadhi, and development of wisdom, panya. And I love this because it really emphasizes that, just like any part of the Buddha's teachings, the Metta Sutta cannot be taken in isolation from the rest. If we take it up deeply, each part of the Buddha Dhamma ultimately leads us through to all the other parts. So if we take the Metta Sutta up completely and fulfill its instructions, this leads to fulfillment and completion of the path. So to begin by diving in to the first two verses. And if you want, you can follow along on page 5 of your chant sheet. But the translation that I like and I will use is another translation of this sutta by Andy Olensky in America that I've modified a little myself so that it's perfectly accurate. Understanding that this was written down sometime after the Buddha's death in Pali, which is a Prakrit, it's a language related to Hindi and Sanskrit. And so there are lots of translations of this verse. And it's actually a really nice exercise if you're learning Pali to take it up and translate it yourself, to really allow it to get in that way. So the first two verses are more than just kind of blah, blah, blah introduction. The Buddha didn't waste words on meaningless speech. Every bit of this sutta means something. And in this case, these two verses describe the essential foundation of the entire practice. And we begin at the ground level, daily life, describing what we can do to support our practice, what we can do so that it's more likely that whatever we do when we sit down will lead, or will be onward leading, sorry. So in the Amaravati translation, it begins with, this is what should be done. In the Andy Olensky translation, it's, this is what ought to be done by one who, etc. To know that that word should, which can rattle some people the wrong way, isn't meant in the negative sense of a demanding imposition from on high, you have to do this. Not at all. It's merely a description of what we should do to support an onward leading and liberating practice. Of course, as we talked about in the beginning of the retreat, we speak of ethical conduct, sila, in this light. But this part of the Metta Sutta really broadens that out to include virtue in the broadest, most general sense. Because it doesn't describe the ethical guidelines per se, so much as it does to describe the optimal attitude for onward leading practice. If we want peace, If we want to be happy, this is what to do. In the Samyutta Nikaya, in the Upanishad Sutta, the Buddha outlines what some people call transcendent dependent origination, which are the causal links leading from faith and continuing upwards all the way to liberation. And in this sequence, happiness is described as one of the key factors for success in the practice. But for many of us, this isn't where we start. And the Buddha understood that very well, I think. And at the beginning of the Metta Sutta here, he gives us really specific advice about ways of being in the world that support happiness, that create happiness, so that happiness can be that supportive condition for inner peace. And while he was addressing a very large group of monks, of course, you understand this applies to all of us, regardless of whether we're ordained, whether we're lay people, regardless of our life situation. And to a great extent, we tend to undervalue these qualities of mind and heart, to slide over them on the way to the meat of the sutta, the important stuff later on. Oh, blah, 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 okay, this is what should be done. We don't really deeply let these in, but they're a vital foundation. So this is what is to be done by one who is skilled in goodness and thoroughly understands the path of peace. And when we're skilled in goodness, and when we understand that path of peace, we've learned the skill of being able to access the good and fully understand the importance of implementing what is beneficial. These are skills and understandings that can be learned and that can be polished. And as that Dhammapada verse that I quoted last week says, the Buddha unequivocally put this as one of the primary tasks to us as yogis, to avoid all evil, to cultivate the good, and to purify the mind. This is the teaching of all the Buddhas. So what this text in the Metta Sutta is telling us is that whether or not we're able to experience that peaceful state is not a matter of chance. It's something we can learn how to do. It's something we can cultivate and develop for ourselves. And I don't know about you, but I like this because it's not something we have to get perfect. It gives us a lot of latitude to make mistakes, and implies that achieving that skill and understanding is actually a matter of trial and error. Yeah, okay, maybe we do make mistakes. Maybe we find the practice challenging. But it's that very falling on our face that's a huge part of the learning. And sometimes really it's the worst, quote unquote, the worst retreats that are the biggest sources of understanding and of polishing. And so this is what's to be done, it says. And because happiness and goodness are skills to be learned, they're not something we can read about or think about or think into. We actually have to do something. And the paradox, of course, as most of you know from your own practice, is that this doing is a very delicate business. In many ways, it's non-doing. Because in the case of cultivating loving kindness, for example, as we're talking about here, we can't create it, we can't make it, we can't force it. That's not the purpose of the practice. As Ariya said yesterday, it's planting the seed of metta, of kindness. It's over and over and over again, inclining the heart towards metta and away from whatever habits we have of controlling, of trying to create something special, of anything unwholesome. This Metta Sutta gives us an avenue of practice to uncover that natural peace that we all have. And as we have been saying in many different ways, finding this peace requires that gradual uncovering and purification of whatever emotional and habitual states are getting in the way of the natural loving kindness. So this non-doing of practice is deeply supported by these qualities at the beginning of the sutta. And they're not, when you look at them, they're not unusual or exotic. They're common and everyday traits that we all have to some extent or another, and that we can all access. Straightness and honesty, humility and modesty, contentment, not being fussy, in other words, calm, not being overly busy or filling our time with activity, considerate and peaceful in both action and speech. And if these qualities are weak or lacking, practice can become difficult. And of course, many of us do encounter this because, to a great extent, our culture and society reward their opposites, doesn't it? I mean, we're taught to be busy, to be competitive. So much so that busyness has become almost a virtue. You meet somebody and say, "Oh, how are you?" And they say, "Oh, I'm so busy." And that's not a complaint. That's, you know, it's like, "I'm so busy." And can you imagine going to a job interview and asking to describe what you think are your strong traits, your strengths, and then saying to them, "Oh, I'm skilled in goodness and I know the path of peace." "I'm humble, I'm not conceited. I'm peaceful and calm and wise and skillful." And you can imagine the guys on the other side going, "Let's give this one a miss." Really, our society doesn't reward these. And in some cases doesn't even like them. But they're essential for practice. So here on retreat, you're allowed to be quiet. You're allowed to be content. You're allowed not to be busy. If you're quiet and keep to yourself, nobody here will call you a loner or an oddball. All the Burmese people will say, oh, very good yogi. And we will too. And you don't have to polish an image here, as you do, many of us have to polish an image outside in the world. But you don't have to do that here. You can just be whatever it is and practice. And it can be such a source of happiness, actually. It's such a relief to put all that stuff down. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to keep up. You don't have to cultivate any spin or any image. You're free just to let the Dhamma unfold and to cultivate metta from wherever you are. And it's the cultivation that matters. So in the practice, it can be very helpful to briefly reflect. Not at any length, but briefly notice these traits, how they're manifesting in you or not. How content are you? Are you, you know, often thinking about what you need in the dining room or in your room? Are you quiet? Or are you needlessly busy? I don't know about you, but often for me in the practice, when things begin to get interesting, I find myself cleaning the corners of my room with a toothbrush. Maybe not literally, but I do all sorts of things as a distraction. So if you find yourself cleaning your room at 3 in the afternoon rather than practicing in the hall or doing walking meditation outside, that might be a moment to reflect. It's like, oh, is this necessary? Why am I doing this? We have a very, by Burmese standards, a really loose timetable with a lot of flex. There's nobody in here taking attendance on the hour for the 1 hour sitting, 1 hour walking, 1 hour sitting, 1 hour walking. We trust you as adults to practice in your own way as suits you best. So there is that flexibility. But just to know that the less you interrupt the practice with busyness, the more momentum the practice will build. My preceptor Upandita used to talk about stop and go yogis. You know, yogis that practiced really diligently and then would go back to their room and do something. And often Burmese yogis, you see them at lunchtime, they're having parties in their room. So a lot of that was addressing that. But we can also have little internal parties in our rooms. So just notice. And notice, for example, if you're straightforward with yourself. Are you honest with yourself about how you are and how the practice is? And this can cut both ways. Are you inflating your experience? Or are you full of self-judgment? I'm a terrible yogi, I'll never succeed. Just notice that. And just use whatever information you get when you do this reflection to adjust yourself. To know, oh, okay, I'm full of self-judgment. Maybe that thought isn't accurate. Or I'm full of pride, and maybe that thought isn't accurate. And just incline back to the middle. Peaceful and calm. not moving around too fast. As I said the other day, it's very supportive of the practice. So running your eye over this list in the sutta and noticing your strengths, noticing the places that may need a little extra attention. And with all of these qualities, again, we really need to understand it's not to force yourself into an idealized box. That actually isn't straightness. The Buddha here was simply directing our attention to the qualities that support metta. He's saying, pay attention to these. He's not saying, do this perfectly. He's saying, notice their presence, even in subtle and fleeting ways, and then feed that. Feed and polish these qualities. And if you find yourself being one of those people who is conditioned to be busy, to be competitive, or distracted, or whatever it is, use this list as an inspiration and a guideline just to keep going with putting it down, doing your best not to give in to these states, not to give in to that unnecessary busyness or that competitiveness or that self-judgment. So that's the first two verses. And verse 3 links these instructions about supportive qualities and the development of metta to the practice itself. And this is the samadhi aspect of the practice. The first is kind of a recap of the ethical, the sila section. He says, one would not do even the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. It's the full stop at the end of the sentence. And then with the last two lines of this third verse, the Buddha moves on to describing the explicit cultivation of loving kindness. First, kind of as a summary and overarching description of what kind of well-wishing we're describing. May they be secure and profoundly well. May all beings be happy in themselves. There's an important thing to pick out of this line, is that we wish for the welfare and happiness of living beings. And the practice applies specifically to them, and not, as it's sometimes described, to parts of living beings. So, for example, it can be helpful in a kind of general sense, as a general attitude, to have an attitude of loving kindness towards one's body as one takes care of it. But to be brushing your teeth and saying, may my teeth be well, happy, and peaceful, may my teeth be well, happy, and peaceful, this is a kind of a modern construct. It's not cultivation of loving kindness as the Buddha taught it and intended it. Not to say there's anything wrong with the attitude of kindness towards our bodies, but to really understand that we cultivate loving kindness to entire beings and living beings. Breathing beings is kind of the designation, the criterion for what is alive. And then in the next line, the Buddha goes on to enumerate them for us. What does he mean? He says, and these are the lines, whatever living beings there may be, weak, strong, omitting none, the great and the mighty, the medium, short or tall, small, seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born or to be born. May all beings be happy in themselves. So, in the practice as we're doing it, we tend to use this sequence of beings that mostly at the beginning is human beings for many of us. But in this text, in the early Buddhist texts, the description is not just human beings, but all beings, without exception, omitting none, whether we like them or not, and equally, no one kind of being special or more deserving based on size or intelligence or location. And this really undercuts our kind of arrogant human tendency to put ourselves above everything. When I was writing this last night, I was mildly annoyed by two tiny little red ants that for some reason were running around on my computer screen. And I was about to brush them off, but then I thought, no, they're not doing any harm there. They're not getting into my computer. They're just for some reason liking the light. And what makes me think I'm any better than those ants? It was a lovely reflection because the very first impulse was a little bit of annoyance. But then the metta came in and it got very sweet then. They were running around on the screen and they could be there. That was okay. It was actually very, very sweet. And then in the interviews, somebody described this morning an experience she had cleaning her kuti that was essentially the same with a mosquito. The metta practice does this. You know, we come off of our pedestal of I'm a human being and, you know, all other beings are subservient to me as a human. And it opens the heart to the ants, the mosquitoes, the earthworms, all these beings that we normally don't pay any attention to or might even kill without even thinking. So in this list, one thing that you probably notice right away is that this early formulation of metta practice, it's not as systematic as the practices we're doing here. The practices we do here are derived from the Visuddhimagga, which is a commentarial text that comes a bit after the early Buddhist texts. And the actual means or sequence we use to develop the loving kindness in this Metta Sutta isn't specified at all. There's no methodical development of metta from one class of beings to another, either by way of category or direction. It's just a list of beings. And first, beings described in terms that we might be able to easily relate to, in terms of strength and size and shape. So, may all beings be at ease. The weak or the strong. That's an easy category to wrap our minds around. Likewise, the great and the mighty, you know, the whales and the elephants. The medium, short, or small. You know, everything in between, right down to the ants. And then, very quickly, though, that list goes on to list kinds of beings that we can probably only imagine. Subtle beings, invisible beings, beings far away, beings not yet born, So these verses instruct us to radiate loving kindness right off the bat, as inclusively or extensively as we can possibly imagine, letting no one kind of being have more than any other. And we can simply say the phrase, may all beings be happy in themselves, in a general way. But really the sutta is encouraging us to get beyond that as a cliche or a thought, and actually try to connect and open to all beings as we radiate loving kindness towards them. And particularly the last part of this list is interesting, because we think of the conventions of space and time as basic facts of existence. This is the conventional world we live in. There's here, there's over there, there's yesterday, and there's tomorrow. But here the Buddha is urging us to develop and radiate metta in a way that really transcends these limits. So how to do this? First, we can do it in very simple ways. For example, maybe you're sitting on your porch after lunch, and one of the, you know, the monastery cats comes by. There's a gray tabby cat that wanders around here, and she's meow, meow, you know, she comes by. And she can easily be a being who is simple to radiate loving kindness to. She's right here. She's kind of cute. And so it's easy to just naturally feel that kind intention, that well-wishing. Because she's a seen being and a heard being and a tangible being. And then by extension, what we can do is then use her as kind of the seed, and radiate the loving kindness to all the cats in the monastery compound, all the cats in the neighborhood, all the cats in the Shan Hills, all the cats in Burma. And you see where it goes. We radiate the loving kindness outwards in that way. You can do that in the same way as we use kind of the categorical development, starting where it's easy and going to where it's harder to imagine. Time, that's space. Time is a slightly harder thing to wrap your mind around, and it's a harder thing to connect with. We connect not only with beings who coexist with us right now, but the metta practice asks us to radiate metta to beings in the future. All beings everywhere, without exception. Not to think about it, not to start, you know, cogitating about you know, parallel universes or anything like that, but just beings to be born. And taken together, this extension in time and space becomes really mind-bogglingly vast. And that's the point, isn't it? That's the point of this practice. And at some point, we really need to surrender in the attempt to imagine individual beings. Imagine all beings. We can't. And to shift the attention instead to the subjective state of open caring itself, and radiating that out and trusting that with the intention that all beings be well, that loving kindness will go out to all beings, whether we know of them or not, whether we can imagine them or not. And the last sentence in this, the well-wishing part, may all beings be happy in themselves. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings be peaceful. And in their own way, we have to cultivate loving kindness for other beings, even if they find happiness in a way that we don't understand, in a way we might not like. But what we're cultivating here is the open-hearted well-wishing for other beings, and whatever makes them happy, rather than what makes us happy. It's not about projection. It's about cultivating a willingness to wish for happiness for others on their terms. Once I was traveling in India with Manindraji, and we were in Sarnath, which is an exquisite place. I know those of you who've been there understand. It's one of the most beautiful of the Buddhist pilgrimage sites. You can really feel the energy of the Dhamma there. And so there we were with Manindra. It was me and Manindra and two other Dhamma friends. And one of the two Dhamma friends was from Singapore, and she had a daughter who had an upcoming wedding, so she wanted to buy saris for the wedding party. So there we were in Sarnath with Manindra in a sari shop. And my two friends were there really enthusiastically digging into the piles of saris, and, you know, they were gorgeous. I mean, these were wedding saris. They weren't cheap. They were the kind that in India cost, you know, $400. Sometimes more, you know, they were exquisite. And I was sitting there getting more and more and more irritated. Sitting here in India, and we're with Manindra, and we're in this stupid sari shop, and I'm not interested in the saris. Completely ignoring that my friends were really happy. Completely ignoring that Manindra was sitting next to me with this sweet smile on his face. He was happy too. I wasn't. I was full of dosa. And then Manindra turned to me. I think he must have felt the energy of irritation. And he turned to me and he said, "They're so happy, aren't they? Isn't it nice to see?" Well, okay, that switched my mind right there. We radiate loving kindness to all beings on their terms, whether we like saris or not, whether we like motorcycles or not, whatever it is, may they be happy. Okay, my friends in the sari shop, that may be not too hard. But of course, what about people who are doing things that you find or know to be unwholesome, and these unwholesome things make them happy? Maybe it's a friend or family member with an addiction problem, or everybody's current least favorite politician. How do we wish them happiness in a way that doesn't contribute to the suffering in the world and their suffering? And the best way to do this is to kind of not wish for them to be happy in getting these unwholesome things that they want or are doing, but to find a way to wish for them happiness that doesn't involve anything unwholesome. So, for example, may you be peaceful and at ease. May you be healthy. Finding a way for these beings to wish them happiness. So this middle part of the sutta that talks about the beings and wishing them well is the kind of the metta part, the explicit metta part of the sutta. It's a description of how metta is to be radiated and to whom. And then it goes on to describe the metta itself, what it is and what it isn't. In the verses that then start, it says, let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world. So this, in a very concise way, is what Ariya was talking about the other day when she was talking about what metta is and what metta isn't, beginning, of course, with what it isn't. And as we've said in a number of ways, loving kindness is the antidote to dosa. And so the first of these verses lays out what we purify in the metta practice and makes it very clear what mind states are absent when metta is present. And as Ariya mentioned yesterday, once we get to the category of the difficult person or the enemy, all sorts of thoughts can arise that look like despising other beings, anger towards other beings, ill will towards other beings. And this is the challenge of this category, because these thoughts can be very intrusive, they can be very oppressive, and they can reappear over and over and over again, cycling patterns of anger, resentment, self-pity, ill will, imagining their harm or downfall, all sorts of things. It can get very dramatic, can't it? I'm sure you all know this. But there are also more subtle layers of harmful thinking that this indirectly refers to. Controlling, judging, self-judgment, fear, anxiety. So these opposites of loving kindness need to be clear and acknowledged. And once the Buddha lays this out, then in the next verse he describes the tender quality of loving kindness, its boundless care. And I have to say, right at the outset of this, I'm not a mother. I have no idea what a mother feels for her only child. We were talking the other day before Monica's meal offering about our mothers, Ariya, Monica, and I, and how none of us have children. We can't imagine what our mothers went through. But even if you don't have kids, this tenderness and this connection that has no boundaries of ego can be directly experienced. Somebody was saying this morning how beautiful it is and what a relief it is to put down control, to open into a place where there's no need to control others or oneself. It is a wonderful relief when control and judgment and irritation drop away. And this practice can be a very deep healing of the heart in the sense of restoring a sense of inner wholeness, especially when what drops away are the layers of self-judgment towards ourselves. And once again in this section, as in the last one, the Buddha instructs us to expand the horizon of our hearts to the very edge of what we can imagine, both in terms of beings, but also shining the light on the boundlessness of that caring itself. Both are vast beyond imagining, and that's the power of metta. Even if we can't imagine it, we can experience it. We can cultivate it. We can develop it. And at the end of the last of these verses, there's the repetitive emphasis on the spirit of metta as being totally and absolutely devoid of even the smallest trace of ill will. Outward and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Unbounded, without exceptions. And this is metta as a Brahma-vihara, a divine abode. And all four of these Brahma-viharas that we chant about in the evening, metta, karuna, mudita, and upeka, have this quality of boundlessness, immeasurable, illimitable, without boundaries, without spatial limits. And in our formal metta practice, the way we're doing it here, of course, we don't start there. It's quite a bit easier than what the Buddha describes in the sutta, because we need baby steps. So we start where it's easy. We start with ourselves, and we begin gradually, gradually to expand the heart's scope. And so then after the verses laying out the suitable objects of our metta, and then the nature of the metta itself, the Buddha then gives a specific direction for the suitable postures and times for the practice, getting very practical. Sitting, standing, walking, or lying down. Free from drowsiness, or one translation of that is as long as one is free of drowsiness. One will resolve upon this mindfulness. That's the literal translation of the next line that in the chant says one should sustain this recollection. This is known as the sublime abiding here. There are a number of things to bring out of this particular verse. In all waking moments, for example, sitting, standing, walking, lying down, at all times and in all postures. And while we often place the sitting practice as preeminent over everything else, the formal sitting practice, the Buddha didn't intend that. He doesn't say, first sitting and then the rest. They're all equal. Sitting, standing, walking, lying down. One should sustain this recollection. One will resolve upon this mindfulness, depending on which translation you like. From the moment we wake up to the moment we go to sleep. And that's very clear, you know, it's like so long as you're devoid of torpor, so long as you're awake, do this. The Buddha doesn't have any expectation we continue this in through sleep. Sometimes it happens. People can have metta dreams. But there's no expectation of that, just when we're awake. using all the postures to cultivate care, to cultivate that mindfulness. And that's the next thing to pick out of this. In the Pali, it uses the word satim, which is explicitly mindfulness. This practice does require mindfulness. You can't do it without it. And often people feel, if they've been doing a lot of vipassana and have never really done a lot of metta practice, there can be that longing to go back to vipassana. But please understand that if you are cultivating loving kindness, if you're connecting with the phrase, repeating the phrase, connecting with the person over and over again, this is a form of mindfulness you're developing. And this verse really shows how the metta practice, which is, as we said, a concentration practice, is a direct support of our insight practice and indirectly develops that quality of mindfulness that's so important for our vipassana practice. I don't want to say anything more about that today because that's a whole different talk. Except to say we're all walking this path with our stuff, with our annoying habits, our painful habits. And it's the power and spirit of loving kindness that connects us deeply and completely in a way that's, we're okay with all of that in ourselves and in others. And bringing that cultivation of that as a mindfulness practice connects us completely to our common beingness. And this is where the metta practice is kind of the back door into insight. We come to a place where there's no difference. A few people have already mentioned that. We're mentioning it this morning, in fact. There's no difference. And how wonderful that is. This is what gives wisdom its heart and its great patience and an ease with all things that allows us to rest with whatever, however it is. And then the last verse directly points to the power of the metta practice as a causal factor for the complete freedom of mind. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from sense desire, is not born again into this world. This is where this goes. It's no less than vipassana. The metta itself is not what frees us, but it's what allows the mind to be freed. So I'll stop there with really the wish. And it's a deeply heartfelt wish that we all know this happiness that metta brings. And may that happiness be the cause and condition for attaining the deepest happiness, which is the peace of Nibbana.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.